There's outrage in Italy after altered photos of women, including some high-ranking female politicians, started appearing online.
Their pictures were taken without their consent, and they were offered to men who started to comment on them.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Also, the government in Lebanon tries to persuade Hezbollah to hand over its weapons.
What's on the table is bringing Hezbollah into the tent against its will.
And 20 years ago, Hurricane Katrina devastated New Orleans.
You have to get yourself up off the ground before you can walk. In New Orleans, we were on the ground.
The Netherlands has advised New Orleans, but has the city enacted any of the guidance?
Also, an enduring musical duo from Egypt and the new major marathon in Sydney. That's all ahead today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for joining us today. We begin in Italy, where Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni says she was disgusted after altered photos of her and other women, including her sister and the head of the opposition party, showed up on an Italian porn site.
Something similar took place earlier this week when revelations about an Italian Facebook group called Mia Moglie, or My Wife, sparked outrage.
Men were publishing pictures of their wives or girlfriends or random women who, of course, were unaware of this, okay, without their consent.
Cecilia Sotilota is an assistant professor of politics at the University for Foreigners of Perugia. She spoke with me today from Rome.
Both cases highlight a deep cultural problem, which has to do, obviously, with the objectification of women's body, right, and the lack of consent and digital violence, we can even call it. But at the same time, there are two different cases, because on the one hand, we have normal people, so to speak. On the other hand, we have famous people.
This trend of putting explicit images of women online without their consent, it is not new. Why do you think that there's so much attention on this particular case in Italy right now?
I think it's just probably the time has come in Italy for having this kind of conversation. There is a big, huge cultural problem, and we're seeing that. It's not just explicit pictures, you know, sometimes it's just women doing very ordinary things, from cleaning to breastfeeding their babies, you know. The point is that their pictures were taken without their consent. The problem is many men, they're actually trying to minimize. There seems to be a big cultural problem.
Although this problem is widespread globally, so of course it's not a problem that exists only in Italy.
Oh, yeah, it is, absolutely. It is. I'm not saying it's just an exclusively Italian issue, but many women that are being, for instance, exposed on this Facebook page, even if they found out that their husbands, boyfriends did that to them, they are not in the position to divorce them because maybe they're financially dependent on these men. So there's this whole conversation. And another dimension to this is that, again, all these men, apparently those whose identity has been verified, because it's very easy, you know, they're there with the names and surnames. I mean, they're professionals, they're doctors, they are, you know, entrepreneurs. We're talking about a problem that really cuts across every layer of society.
So are there also people who are defending these practices?
There's been cases reported by the media of women who recognize themselves on this Facebook page, and then they reported horrifying conversations with their partners who apparently were playing down the whole issue. They were saying that, oh, you don't want to divorce me, you know, for this little irrelevant thing. It's not that serious. So they were sort of playing down the whole thing. So we are hearing reports and we are hearing like men sort of minimizing this whole situation.
What kind of legal protections are in place in Europe to prevent this kind of thing? Are there enough legal avenues to get this sorted out?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, again, it very much depends on the outlet. In the case, for instance, of the Facebook group, it's also like the legal consequences that men individually will be facing as per Italian criminal law. So this means, for instance, that it depends very much on the situations. The police will need to sort of comb through this page and see case by case. But for instance, there's defamation there. There may be the violation of copyright. There may even be, for instance, issues of minor rights, you know, because how do we know that these people that are depicted, whose pictures have been posted there, are of age? There's multiple sort of legal consequences that may be playing out over the next months.
Cecilia Sotilota is with the University for Foreigners of Perugia.
In Lebanon, there is a concerted effort underway to disarm Hezbollah. One top U.S. official says it could turn out to be historic. The militia was founded back in the 1980s with military and financial help from Iran. Hezbollah has long controlled southern Lebanon and still has strong support from the country's Shia population. For years, the group was seen as one of the most powerful militias in the Middle East. But the war with Israel last year weakened Hezbollah, and as the world's Shirin Jafari reports, it now faces new pressure to give up its military arsenal.
Hezbollah ties its military activities to a broader struggle. It portrays itself as an essential force against what it calls Israeli aggressions in Lebanon, basing this on the history of Israeli invasion and occupation of parts of Lebanon. The powerful militia used to get a lot of help from Iran. That's no longer the case, says Thanasis Kambanis, a Middle East analyst with the think tank Century International.
Iran could send people, weapons, it could send cash. That is over. Syria and Lebanon are no longer friendly states.
Syria, through which Iran used to send money and weapons to Lebanon, has a new government. In Lebanon, Hezbollah has lost its top leadership in Israeli attacks. Last September, it suffered one of the biggest blows to its ranks in its history. Thousands of pagers and walkie-talkies that belonged to its members exploded simultaneously, killing and injuring many. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu confirmed that Israel was behind the attacks. Now the Lebanese government is under pressure from the U.S. and Israel to force Hezbollah to give up its arms.
Hezbollah's agenda is not Lebanon's agenda. Hezbollah has an agenda inconsistent with you thriving and surviving.
This week, U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham was in Beirut along with Tom Barracks, U.S. ambassador to Turkey and envoy to Syria. He addressed the Lebanese press about the topic. Graham said the Lebanese people would benefit from a strong national army instead of a militia group.
If you can pull that off, that would be the biggest accomplishment in modern history of Lebanon.
Kambanis says the plan put forward by the Lebanese government takes a different approach than the past.
So they're not looking at disarming Hezbollah by force or coercively destroying Hezbollah's military structure. They're looking at a voluntary integration of some of Hezbollah's fighters into national fighting forces.
Those forces would be paid, he says, just like others in the army. In that meeting in Beirut, Barak said that Saudi Arabia and Qatar are ready to invest in an economic zone in southern Lebanon if Hezbollah agrees to lay down its arms. Prime Minister Netanyahu has called the plan a, quote, momentous decision. He said Israeli forces will withdraw from southern Lebanon after Hezbollah disarms. But Hezbollah's leader, Naim Qassem, has rejected the idea, at least in public.
This government decision does not have national consensus. We will not abandon the weapons that protect us from our enemy. We will not allow Israel to roam freely in our country and kill the resistance fighters and seize the south.
Randa Slim, fellow with the Foreign Policy Institute at Johns Hopkins University, says the war with Israel, as well as the major loss and devastation in Lebanon, has changed the discourse among Hezbollah supporters.
You are, for the first time, seeing a real debate inside the Shia community about the usefulness of these weapons in preserving, safeguarding the interests of the community, but also in protecting the community from Israeli aggression and deterring that Israeli aggression.
Slim says that the plan to take away Hezbollah's arms will likely be gradual and carried out in multiple phases. One scenario, she adds, is that the group agrees to give up its bigger arms, like rockets, but keeps the smaller ones. There are multiple armed factions in Lebanon besides Hezbollah, says Kambanis, but they don't have the power to drag the country into war.
What's on the table is bringing Hezbollah into the tent against its will and cutting off its autonomous power to dominate the state and forcing it to become one of the many warlord-led militias that still can wreak havoc within the Lebanese context, but cannot spark a regional war.
The Lebanese army is scheduled to deliver its plan to the government by Sunday. The cabinet will then review and make its final decision. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
At this point, you are probably familiar with this sound. drones. They are used as eyes in the air for all kinds of things, including spotting stranded mountain climbers.
In this YouTube video, a drone captured the summit of Mount Pobeda from above. It is the highest peak in remote Kyrgyzstan in Central Asia. As the drone camera pivots, you can make out a tiny pale orange tent in the snow below. The tent belonged to an injured 47-year-old Russian climber named Natalia Nagovitsina. The World's Jerry Haddon picks up the story from here.
As the drone approaches the tent suddenly opens. A single hand emerges, waving back and forth frantically. It was climber Natalia Nagovitsina's only way of telling the world she was still alive, because she had no radio and couldn't walk or even stand. 7 days earlier, she'd fallen and broken her leg. To understand how Nagovitsina got there, we need to go back 4 years, when she and her husband, Sergei, were busy summiting many of the region's highest peaks. In 2021, on another high mountaintop in Kyrgyzstan, Sergei suffered a stroke. There's a documentary film about it in Russian called Staying with Khan Tengri. That's the name of the mountain. Natalia stayed with her husband in their tent near the peak. Natalia radios a climber from the base camp below. What is your husband's condition? He's just lying on his side, she says. You've got to come down, the climber implores her. There's nothing to be done for him. I understand what you're saying, Natalia responds, but I am not leaving him. Natalia remained by her husband's side as rescuers tried to reach them. My husband said to me, they know best, she said. If they go down, you should go. And I said, I've made my decision. After that, my husband hugged me so tightly that I knew I'd made the right choice. Nagovitsina stayed with Sergei for two bitterly cold nights at over 22,000 feet. Rescuers reached them, but it was too late for Sergei. Nagovitsina descended a widow with a mission. First to resummit Khan Tengri and leave a plaque in honor of Sergei next to where he died. In this video, she toasts him in silence with a swig of kvass. Then this year, she set out to complete their dream of summiting Mount Pobeda, and that's when she broke her leg, just as she'd begun her triumphant descent from the top. As the days passed, two helicopters tried to reach her. One crashed. There were no fatalities. A second turned back in bad weather.
A helicopter rescue operation at this altitude is technically possible.
This is Hermann Brugger, the founder of the Institute of Mountain Emergency Medicine in Italy. He says that the region on the border between Kyrgyzstan and China presents huge challenges for rescuers.
Mount Pobeda, the northernmost 7,000-meter peak in the world, is highly exposed to extreme weather and harsh winds. Even with favorable weather conditions, landing on a ridge or operating with a longline system is an incredibly difficult task.
Rescuers also tried to reach Nagovitsina by foot. On day two, a colleague, Italian Luca Sinigaglia, managed to bring her food, cooking gas, and a sleeping bag. But on a second attempt, he succumbed to altitude sickness and hypothermia. So the days passed, with Nagovitsina's condition undoubtedly worsening. Hermann Brugger says there were three things working against her.
The altitude of 7,000 meters, where oxygen saturation, even at rest, drops to fatal levels unless a person is fully acclimatized.
Add to that the cold, he says, with temps dropping into the minus 20s at night.
And lastly, the injury that left her immobilized the entire time. So given these conditions, it was already extraordinary that she seemed to be alive after 7 days.
That drone footage on day seven of Nagovitsina waving is the last image of her alive. This Wednesday, 15 days after her accident, rescuers sent up a thermal drone which can detect body heat. It found no signs of life coming from the little orange tent. For The World, I'm Cherry Haddon.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. It's been 20 years to the day since Hurricane Katrina made landfall in New Orleans. The big question that storm forced on the city, how do you coexist with water? Not only is that still the question for the Crescent City, it's also one that communities across the globe are urgently trying to answer as sea levels rise and cities everywhere scramble to adapt. In the early days after Katrina, one country in Europe took special interest in how New Orleans might learn to live with water differently going forward, the Netherlands.
The Dutch have been trying to solve these problems for a long time, and New Orleans has been a real laboratory to learn.
That's New Orleans architect David Wagner speaking with me in 2013. Back then, Wagner was on a personal mission to make New Orleans more resilient before the next storm. He'd been motivated by something his elderly father, a Louisiana lawmaker, said to him.
He said to me, "What are you doing about it?" And I said, I'm not, what am I supposed to do? I'm just a citizen.
Haunted by the question, Wagner did end up getting involved, becoming part of an urban renewal committee for New Orleans and going with then U.S. Senator Mary Landrieu on a fact-finding mission to the Netherlands, a country below sea level that was actually built from reclaimed lakes over centuries and with a long history of flooding that has shaped the physical environment. In the Netherlands, you can take a ruler and every 5 feet there's a ditch for drainage. They also have a vast network of canals and dikes. Plus, the country is protected from the North Sea by an impressive sea surge barrier called the Delta Works. To call the Delta Works a major project is an understatement. It took 4 decades and billions of dollars to build a barrier strong enough to hold back the restless North Sea. On his first visit to the Netherlands, David Wagner could see the results of all that careful flood management before his plane even landed in Amsterdam.
You see the water glistening around, and then there's less water, but there's water still around the airport.
The lesson from the Netherlands, as he saw it, was not to seal water away with pavement, as we tend to do in American cities, but to envision a New Orleans where the movements of people, streets, and waterways could flow harmoniously together. He wanted a greener city that allowed water in through efficiently managed canals, for example. That's what Wagner told me in 2013. He started by bringing Dutch planners to New Orleans to collaborate. He was optimistic it could be done despite the investment it would take, not to mention a drastic shift in thinking for American cities.
We're trying to arrest the unquestioned pave, pipe, pump methodology.
Pave the ground, pipe the water, and pump it to customers, that conventional way of thinking of how to manage water had to change to make the city more resilient. It has been more than a decade since then, so I thought it was time to check back in with Wagner to see how that's been going. David, when we met in 2013, you were optimistic. I mean, there was possibility, you had ideas, there were pathways to improvement. 20 years after Katrina, what are your thoughts now?
My long-term business partner called me a grim optimist. I still believe this is the best way forward.
If you sense there's a but coming, you're right. Wagner has seen some improvements, but he gave a rather mixed report card when we spoke.
There's progress in New Orleans toward this, but it takes a while to organize the troops. And you have to get yourself up off the ground before you can walk. And I think in New Orleans we were on the ground. And so and we've gone through all the other things that the rest of America and the rest of the world has in this last 10 years, 12 years since we talked. But I think that if you look at a city like Delft, if you look at what the Dutch did with their oil money, the offshore oil money, how they invested it in transportation and transit-oriented development, they did big things, but they weren't just drawing to draw. They were drawing to build. And as an architect, I wish so much we understood that the power of building and not just drawing and not just iterating and having ideas, but actually doing it.
I mean, it sounds like you're saying, well, look, the Dutch go big when they say let's go big. The Delta Works is a great example of that. Is that what New Orleans should be doing?
Yes, because the scale of the problem is large. I think a criticism that the Dutch would make of New Orleans is we're doing a lot of fine, small things, but they don't add up in time. And I think you have to look at, the scale of your problem and the scale of the solutions that will address the problem. There's a comfort level with doing rain gardens. I mean, New Orleans has built green streets. New Orleans has built living shorelines. New Orleans has done some other things in this period of time, which are all good. But it takes too many rain gardens with too much operations and maintenance to ever manage the water that we have here.
So recalling our visit over 10 years ago, I was struck by one fix you had mentioned at the time, addressing the medians all over New Orleans, known as the neutral ground. So reimagining them not as earth, but as canals. Remind us how that could help and whether any of the neutral grounds have been transformed.
Well, there's funding for, and there's design done to convert neutral grounds to blue corridors, blue ways, not built. And, you know, what we need to see is things built. We need to see water. You know, the real critique that the Dutch make of New Orleans, apart from scale, is that we're reluctant to embrace surface water. Parts of New Orleans are below sea level. Once you're below sea level, you're inside a levee system. You are, in their terms and in international terms, a polder. They critique New Orleans as a hidden polder, a place where there is no visible water. How can you live below sea level without visible water? So the opportunity you saw, Marco, we are just beginning to implement.
Let's turn to other cities around the globe. I mean, New Orleans is not the only one dealing with flooding. And on our drive in New Orleans back in 2013, you expressed these concerns.
You see, New Orleans is really, in my mind, a test case for the rest of America. Beyond the United States, it's how on earth we're going to do something about this. Because what's going to happen in Vietnam? What's going to happen in Thailand? What's going to happen in Indonesia? You know, what's going to happen in Bangladesh? You don't want all these societies failing, you know.
So, David, as you said in that clip we just heard, New Orleans is a test case for the rest of the world. Despite kind of the mixed report card in New Orleans, what about globally? Have any of the cities you mentioned there, have they made any headway?
We worked with people in Jakarta and went there, and they came to New Orleans, and they understood our issue, and we understood their issue. Been to Ho Chi Minh and talked there. Work continued in China. What we discover, what we find is that every culture has a difference. There's a different history. You can absorb that. You can analyze that. But you really need to be in the milieu, in the place, and have staying power. My words then seem ambitious, but maybe ambition's good.
Since our last visit, what's the news in terms of preparedness in New Orleans? What improvements have been made on advice from the Dutch?
To do what the Dutch have done, you have to build a coalition. People have to get their noses in one direction. And so I think the fundamentals are much better understood by the populace and the agencies. Things that are maybe not so alluring, like a groundwater network throughout the city, has been installed by the Dutch so that at least in the soft delta weak soil, we know where the water is below the surface. You know, we stick with the plan. We advocate these investments and, you know, hopefully stay the course to see New Orleans in particular and other places, but New Orleans in particular at this anniversary time, recommit and imagine itself as a water city. Imagine the beauty of that, imagine the benefit of that, and embrace this identity.
David Wagner is co-founder of the architecture firm Wagner and Ball. He spoke with us about water management in New Orleans 20 years after Hurricane Katrina.
I'm Tinku Ray, executive editor at The World. The government's decision to eliminate federal funding for public media is a devastating blow to communities nationwide. The World is also affected by this defunding. Since our launch in 1996, The World has been an integral part of the public media system, airing on nearly 370 public radio stations across the US and Canada, taking you to places you may never have heard of and bringing you the stories that connect us on this planet. Without federal support, local stations, especially in rural and underserved areas, face deep cuts or even closure. Vital public service alerts, news, storytelling, and programming like The World will be impacted. The World has weathered many storms, and we remain steadfast in our commitment to being your trusted source for human-centered international news, shared with integrity and care. We believe public media is about truth and access for all. As an independent, non-profit newsroom, we aren't controlled by billionaire owners or corporations. We are sustained by listeners like you. Now, more than ever, we need your help to support our global reporting work and power the future of the world. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and to make your donation now. That's theworld.org/give. On behalf of the entire team here at The World, thank you. You make our work possible.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. One of the biggest musical acts to come out of Egypt in the past century is a duo of an Arabic poet and a blind player of the oud. It's a Middle Eastern stringed instrument that dates back many centuries. In the 1960s, this duo transformed Egypt's music scene with a new kind of popular music. Their tunes and biting lyrics were provocative and became a thorn in the sides of Egyptian dictators for decades.
Years later, their music was discovered by a new generation. Eventually, it became part of the soundtrack of the Arab Spring, played on heavy rotation in Cairo's Tahrir Square in the 2010s. Dana Balut of the Kerning Cultures Network brings us one of our favorite stories about music and politics.
Back in the 1960s, the El Mugi household in downtown Cairo was famous for its parties. At least once a week, a crowd would cram into its living room.
My grandmother's living room would take, like, squeezed together maybe like 20 people.
Sahar El-Mugi was just a young girl then, but she remembers the room well, and she remembers how it would fill up with poets and artists and intellectuals.
Writers, people from the radio.
And then, after everybody had arrived, these two figures would usually stand up in the crowd. One of them would pick up a oud, and the other would pull out a poem he'd prepared. Together, they'd start to perform. Their names were Sheikh Imam and Ahmad Fuad Nagim.
I used to squeeze myself into those grown-ups and just listen. Imam had this kind of genius, actually.
Sahar didn't know this at the time, but what she was watching from the floor in that room full of grown-ups was the start of a new era in Egyptian popular music.
They were very special times.
Over the next two decades, they became household names. People across the country would play their music. But the more popular they became, the more dangerous they were to the ruling party. Again and again, their songs would land them in prison. Under both the regimes of Gamal Abdel Nasser and Anwar el-Sadat, freedom of expression was closely monitored, and any criticism of state affairs, even in songs, could be a punishable offense. But to others, they were heroes, two icons who put into words the disillusionment ordinary people in Egypt had been feeling for a long time.
I think that both of them together, I mean, this artistic experiment, this thing tapped into the Egyptian psyche at a time that this psyche was very bruised. And it gave voice to this pain.
This is producer Nadine Shaker.
Sheikh Imam was born Imam Ahmed Muhammad Isa in a small village outside of Cairo in the year before the 1919 Egyptian Revolution, while the country was still under British occupation. When he was around 5 months old, he lost his eyesight and would never get it back. But he was always a keen student. By the time he was in his early teens, he was able to make money by reciting the Quran at public events. One time, a local sheikh heard him performing and encouraged him to travel to Cairo to carry on his education.
Which ultimately proves to be very short-lived.
This is historian Andrew Simon. He's the author of a book called Media of the Masses, Cassette Culture in Modern Egypt.
And so Imam is expelled from his Islamic Institute because he is caught by a fellow student who reports him to his instructors for listening to Quranic recitation over the radio at a cafe.
When Imam was expelled, he was made homeless and ended up living in a working-class neighborhood of Cairo, spending his nights sleeping in mosques. For a while, he made a meager living performing at religious festivals and weddings, or reciting the Quran at private homes for special occasions. And it was in one of these performances that he met a well-known music teacher called Sheikh Darwish al-Hariri, who took Imam under his wing as a student and started giving him formal music lessons.
And then during the course of these lessons, one of the things that happens is that Imam hears this other individual playing the oud, And he learns that the other guy playing the oud is also blind. And so this is something that shocked him, that a blind person could actually play that instrument. And so he decides to take it up. So by 1945, then, Imam ends up committing himself to his art on a full-time basis. Flash forward a number of years, 1962 arrives, and that's when he crosses paths with Ahmed Fuad Nigam, a poet who was known for writing in colloquial Egyptian Arabic. And then those two go on to form a very dynamic duo.
The two men formed a strong bond, and together they started composing and singing political songs. They even moved into the same apartment together in Cairo and dedicated everything to their music. And then, in 1967,
Israeli forces launched an all-out attack on Arab forces at the Sinai Desert.
Egypt's defeat in the Six-Day War and Israel's annexation of the Sinai Peninsula were a huge blow to Nasser's regime. But it also helped open society a bit. As people became more disillusioned with the war and Nasser's rule, they started to come together to find alternative ways to voice their dissent. Music was one example of that.
And so Nigam and Imam together end up undermining the stories that are being told by the state. And that's why they gain traction, and that's why they become icons, especially among the Egyptian left.
One other factor is that the two of them belong to a very low economic segment of society, and hence people identified.
So, translated into English, thank God we knocked beneath our armpits. How lovely that our officers have come back from the line of fire.
This is Elliot Kulla, professor of Arabic literature at Georgetown University. We asked him to talk us through Imam's song, Alhamdulillah Khabbatna, or Thank God We Knock Beneath Our Armpits.
It begins in this kind of simple way, but already in that first couple lines you hear, they're making fun of the fact that the Egyptian army has been beaten. This poem landed those two in deep, deep trouble with the regime. This is the first time they stepped over the line, and this is part of the reason why they became first invited and then banned from state radio.
So this was when they started to become very famous. Along with this fame, earlier recordings were leaked.
This is Zain al-Abidin Fuad, a well-known Egyptian poet who often collaborated with Imam. Zain spoke to us in Arabic, and we had an actor voice his lines in English.
The security apparatus took these songs to Nasser. They were arrested and weren't released until after Nasser's death.
I mean, they were arrested and imprisoned several times throughout their lives. I mean, they were frequent flyers when it came to Egypt's prison, and they were well-known entities from the perspective of the security apparatus.
But one of their biggest hits was yet to come. In 1974, U.S. President Richard Nixon touched down in Cairo on a state visit with Egyptian President Anwar Sadat. The first visit by a U.S. head of state in decades. At home, he was embroiled in the Watergate scandal, and his impeachment hearings were well underway. When Nixon stepped out onto the tarmac at Cairo International Airport, he was greeted by a huge crowd. There was a military procession, a gaggle of media people, dignitaries, and Egypt's president, Anwar Sadat.
This was not a silent affair. And so you have Egyptians chanting things like, "We believe in Nixon, welcome to a man of peace," in Arabic. There are other chants that are sounding off in English. People saying, "Long live Sadat, long live Nixon."
But away from the crowds and the loudspeakers and the billboards, Nigam and Imam were at work.
I just imagine them sitting in a cafe, hearing about all of this commotion and festivities surrounding Nixon's visit, and then penning this poem and setting it to song and offering this completely different narrative of his welcome.
شرفت يا نكسون بابا يا بتاعي الأوترجين عملوا لك قيمة وسيمة سلاطين الفول والزيت فرشوا لك.
Thank you for gracing us with your presence, Daddy Nixon, Mr. Watergate Man. They threw you quite a show, those sultans of fava beans and oil.
What?
They rolled out the red...
What? This kind of poetry, which draws a story, which draws an image, which makes fun of the American president at the time, who was coming to Egypt for an official visit. I mean, they were crazy. They were totally nuts in a great way.
The real point of this poem is not just making fun of Nixon, it's more making fun of the Egyptians who bend over backwards to host them. And the song, sort of, it's them that the song is skewering, and skewering them for being obsequious.
A couple of months after Nixon's welcome and Nixon Baba begins to circulate, Nigam, Imam, they were all arrested.
But in prison or not, their music continued to grow as part of the counterculture, especially under Sadat. It was a time when musicians became famous through TV or radio broadcast. But these were state-controlled, and there was no way they were going to play Nigma and Imam's protest music.
I mean, there was this very clear decision on the part of the decision makers not to include this kind of work in the mainstream media.
So the answer? Cassette tapes, some of which were recorded in Sahar's family home.
Tapes that are being created, copied, pirated, circulated by individuals. In the case of Imam, piracy was encouraged. And so you have people recording Imam or pirating these cassettes and then taking these cassettes to London, to Paris, Algeria, Tunisia, Lebanon, the Gulf, and then people pirating the cassettes there.
Of course. Of course. Why wouldn't their tapes go to Maghreb and Algeria and Syria and have an audience? Why wouldn't it? It's the same wound, the same brokenness, the same aspirations for freedom and for justice, equality.
Everyone we spoke to said that Nigma and Imam's partnership came to an end sometime around the mid-1980s. By then, Imam was well into his 60s, but nobody knew exactly why they split up.
There is some tension between them in terms of their commitment to their work and kind of questions of celebrity and fame.
In the summer of 1995, a small article was printed in the back pages of Al Ahram newspaper, noting that Sheikh Imam has passed away. It was short and, perhaps intentionally, unremarkable.
And so people reading this, Imam's compatriots, his friends, his fans, were so outraged. They felt this obituary was so irreverent and insulting that they actually end up submitting a second obituary. So that's where we see Imam referred to as the artist of the people. And so that's kind of where his story, where his life wraps up.
So Sahar had kept her cassettes from Nigma and Imam's glory days, but she rarely listened to them.
It brings me back to my own history, my own childhood, my parents who are no longer there, Imam and Nigma who are not, I mean, very, very heavy and painful. However, in 2011, when there was a rebirth for Nigma and Imam, I could tune in and I could sing without pain.
In 2011, during the Egyptian Revolution, their music was revived. Lines from Nigma's poems were chanted as slogans, and Sheikh Imam's songs were covered by musicians and sung by thousands in Tahrir Square.
They were reborn to generations they didn't know about them. And with the collective voice in the squares, I was shaken, completely shaken, but not in a painful way. It was joy that I knew they would go on living. I think what they are offering us is something similar to what they offered back in the 1960s and 70s. This period, as Egyptians, we didn't have freedoms. We didn't have equality. We didn't have everything, just like today. And despite that, they wrote and they sung, people listened, and hence it's actually about those broken moments, no matter how dire the circumstances are, no matter how tied up we all are, a change will happen because this is the law of life. Life constantly brings about changes.
That was Dana Balut of the Kerning Cultures Network telling the story of Egypt's Sheikh Imam and Ahmad Fuad Negm, a musical duo from the 1960s. We first aired that story in 2024. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. This weekend is a big one for runners in Australia. The Sydney Marathon is Sunday.
It is the first year that the race is being run under its new designation as a major marathon, joining the list of other global majors in London, Berlin, Tokyo, Boston, New York, and Chicago.
The World's Bianca Hillier filed this report late last year about how Sydney won the honor and what the impact will be for the land down under.
The World Marathon Majors are sponsored by Abbott, the healthcare company, and they represent the biggest, most prestigious marathons in the world. Professionals seek out the races for massive paydays and career milestones, while amateurs sign up to complete the series and collect all 6 stars. Well, now 7 stars.
To have an Abbott World Marathon Major in Australasia, you know, this is about expanding marathon running and the community of marathon running around the world.
Hugh Brasher heads up the London Marathon. He says Sydney is the first addition to the majors list since 2013, when Tokyo joined. Since then, the number of people running marathons has exploded.
3, 2, 1. And we are away in the TCS Sydney Marathon for 2024.
In Sydney's race alone, participation increased by 400% from 2022 to 2024. This year, it's up another 40%, and some of the biggest names in marathoning will toe the line, including Sifan Hassan, the reigning Olympic marathon champion from the Netherlands, and Kenya's Eliud Kipchoge, who is widely considered the greatest marathoner of all time. That, Brasher says, is one of the draws for everyday runners.
There is no other sport that you are standing on exactly the same start line as the gods of the sport. You know, you can't play on the centre court of Wimbledon. You can't go around the Sao Paulo racetrack at the same time as Max Verstappen.
Exactly how Sydney became a major is a bit unclear. In an email last fall, Abbott World Marathon Majors told me they don't share the full list of criteria publicly, but races are judged on over 100 metrics, from runner experience to course signage to aid stations. They have to pass each of those tests for 2 years in a row. When Sydney's major status was announced last fall, many runners were thrilled.
The most exciting news coming out of Sydney today.
I don't know about anyone else, but I'm gassed. I've always wanted to go to Australia. Hopefully I can get a place.
Sydney Marathon se acaba de convertir en la séptima World Marathon Major.
Before Sydney was added, the closest major marathon for Australians was in Tokyo, and that's still a 10-hour flight from Sydney. Not everyone is happy, though.
Six was enough. So this crazy challenge I've set myself is now harder, going to take much longer to do, and way more expensive.
Australia is far away from a lot of places, and some runners fear their dream of finishing all the majors will continue to get less realistic. But Hugh Brasher from the London Marathon says achieving more geographic diversity is important for the series.
There absolutely will be a limit, but I also think that surely Africa, surely China, there should be a major in those countries.
Cape Town and Shanghai are currently candidates to join the majors, by the way. But for now, the focus is on Sydney, and New South Wales Minister for Jobs and Tourism, John Graham, sees dollar signs.
This is a big economic boost to the state, $300 million over the course of a decade.
The precedent is there. Other majors regularly bring in hundreds of millions of dollars per race. That's from runners and all the people that come along with them. Here's Brasher again.
We know that the average person running the London Marathon brings 5.4 people with them.
And who knows what other legacies the newly minted race will leave, because the Sydney Marathon itself is the product of another major sporting event, the 2000 Summer Olympics.
A few seconds, but here we are, ready for a start.
They're away.
The race was first held as a test event before the Games. It was so successful that it's continued ever since, with some changes to the course over the years. On Sunday, runners will cross over the Sydney Harbour Bridge within the first few miles, and they'll end at the iconic Opera House. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Finally, we are going to head into Labor Day weekend with a little music. Retumba la tierra.
Retumba la Tierra, The Earth Trembles, is the title track of the latest record from Calle Mambo. The band from Chile likes to shake things up, musically and lyrically. They get into issues like migration and the environment.
The lyrics are written from the perspective of Earth, telling us what we humans have done to it. The song builds and builds and then kicks into high gear with a message of hope, telling us it is time to reconnect and care for what we can still save. At least that's how Calle Mambo likes to describe the song.
Retumba la Tierra is Calle Mambo's third album. The group formed in 2013 after they met in Munich, Germany, where each of them had been busking on separate street corners playing their own styles of Latin music.
Now they are a five-piece band playing everything from traditional Andean panpipes to electric guitars, plus vocals, rapping, and singing. This track, La Peregrina, The Pilgrim, is about single mothers and the journeys they sometimes have to take to provide for their families.
Se va, That is The World on this Friday. Tune in Monday for a special back-to-school edition of the show. We'll focus on the dramatic changes for international students coming to the U.S. and the people leaving American higher education for universities abroad.
The loss in intellectual capital to this country that has benefited for decades of the brain trust from the rest of the world cannot be underestimated.
That's Monday on the show.
The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for listening and have a restful Labor Day weekend.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. macfound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include the Alice Shaver Charitable Trust, Doty and Billy Crockett, Catherine Harris and Tom Kaiser, and Lynn and Bruce Dayton. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.